Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show.
What is happening, everybody out there? My name is David, and this is the Most High Show. And we want to thank everybody for tuning in. And today, we're going to do what we usually do here is we're going to catch up and talk about a story. And this story is focused on my friend Joe. What's happening, Joe, man?
What's up, everybody?
Hey, thank you for being here, man. I appreciate that, dude. I think, so what I try to do is, right, what's been working for us here is that I try to do it it's like a circular thing, man, if that makes any sense. So what I want to know is, what's today look like? What's present day life for Joe?
Present day life for me is really great. You know, I feel accomplished, and you know, my relationships with my children are growing. Yeah. They are wanting to be with me more, and it just tickles me pink. You know, I go and they call me daddy. They know who I am, and I'm doing everything I can to be the best father that I can. And you know, and there's other accomplishments. So, you know, I've held a job, a steady, stable job, and gainfully employed the entire time I've been sober. Right. And that's a huge change from bouncing from job to job.
That's a huge thing, man.
Yes, sir. And you know, school's going good. I've actually sat down and committed and applied myself in school and being academic.
And what school is it?
Liberty University.
That's right. That's a good place.
And it has challenges. You know, life has some challenges, but they're different, healthy challenges that I'm facing these days. And my worst day now is way better than my best day then using.
Those accomplishments, being a father, you understand what I'm saying? Having a relationship with your children, right? Keeping a job, I mean, and going to school, right? Those things, you know, regardless of what your past looks like, present day, if all those things are working in your life, that's like manageability, and that, I don't know if manageability is an actual word, but that your life is manageable right now. And not only manageable, it's fruitful and it's good. You know what I mean? And that's for anybody, in anybody's life today. So let's start off on, you know, where using becomes a part of your life. You know, when does that happen?
Well, I started using at a very young age. Mm-hmm. I would say at the end of elementary school into middle school.
Okay.
I was moved around a lot as a child. Mm-hmm. Changing schools, always the new guy. Yeah. There's a lot of fights that stem from that. Mm. And you know, I didn't fit in anywhere, or I didn't feel like I did.
Right.
And so I was having those identity crises, and I found it in marijuana and hanging out with those guys. I felt like I fit in if I was high.
Or that group of dudes.
That group of dudes. If I was high, I was cool. Because at that point in my life where I was at and where I grew up, if you were high at that point in my life, it seemed to be cool.
Right.
You wasn't frowned upon.
And I think that's I don't think that's changed. I think it's...
Right.
You know, there's especially, I think, let's see, out of elementary school into middle school, that's 12, 13,
mm-hmm. 14? A little younger, 11,
12.
Than
11, 12, somewhere around there. So just thinking about it, I mean... You know, you're at those ages, you are so innocent to everything, mm-hmm. and everything that isn't, you know, I guess anything off the bar a little bit is cool.
Yeah.
Able to it's almost brave, like taking the risk of doing something like
right.
that, having a group of people that has nothing to do with or wouldn't do anything like that. You know, they're all looking like, oh, you know, I don't think that's changed. I deal with a lot of teens today, and that's to be the cool guy or the cool girl. They make choices like that. You know what I mean? So you're going through and you're trying to fit in, you're moved. Now, are the geographics of this move, is it huge? Like, are you going from one side of the country to this side of the country, or is it in this area, just kind of like different school districts? Like, what does that look
like? It was different school districts, and you know, from elementary to middle school, I think we swapped schools 5 times. So, yeah. You know, that's a huge.
That's tough, man.
Yeah, that's like almost every year a different school. So it was always being the new kid, and you know, it wasn't very far moves, but it was different school districts within the counties, but in the state of Georgia.
Right.
And it was tough. You know,
that is tough because, man, it's, you know, your friendships, your buddies mean everything at that time of your life. You know
right.
what I mean? And
mm-hmm.
to never be able to be a part of that tribe or always leaving a tribe, that has to mess with you really bad. You know what I mean? So you get in there, so you're in middle school and everything like that, and that's where it kind of starts, right?
That's where it got, I really slid, the cheese slid off the cracker, so to speak. I really started hanging out with the wrong crowd.
Yeah.
Was real active in sports, but then, you know, started, you know, smoking pot.
Yeah.
And hanging out with the wrong crowd, and then just slipped further, skipping class, fighting a lot. I think I got 36 fights in my 7th grade year.
Like, wow.
Yeah, almost got.
That's almost more days than, of more fights than school.
Right. And
that's
then
crazy.
Progressing on into the 8th grade, you know, I got caught with a joint at school or some weed. Mm-hmm. And so I got kicked out of school at the end of the 8th grade year and had to go to one of those alternative schools to finish my school year. And
that's where everybody's cool, right? Everybody's smoking and partying at alternative ed, right?
Yeah. And so, you know, then I was like, you know, I'm cool. I'm an outcast from school. So I kind of fit deeper in with that clique.
Yeah.
You know, and it was just by the time through that summer break and into my first year of 9th grade, I was just doing whatever, whenever, you know, into the pills and everything. And it just really took a hold of me.
So I would say, like, at that time, your lifestyle was probably just as addicting as the actual using of marijuana and drinking or whatever, right?
Oh, yeah. I was a very social animal. I was hanging out with friends. It was cool. Skateboarding, you know, hanging out, just terrorizing the neighborhood was just, that was the thing to do when I was growing up. And it became a huge part of my life. And, you know.
Where is it where you feel like, man, this is, like, do you realize when the dependence started, like, on the actual... on actual drugs, I mean, or when, maybe it escalates to different drugs.
Right. So, in fact, it did. You know, I used to just be a hardcore marijuana smoker all the way up through my 20s. And then, you know, I started doing, I guess around 18, I started doing meth or ice. And
that's a big jump,
and that was
right?
a game changer. But I was still, you know, I didn't notice that a habit had formed other than my marijuana addiction. And it was, I was smoking a lot of pot at that age. I mean, I was doing an ounce a week, you know, and it just escalated, you know. And I still, all the way up through my 20s, I didn't realize I had an issue, but a lot of bad shit kept out. I couldn't keep, you know, food on the table. You know, I went through, got married, had a divorce due to drugs, and then ice or meth really kicked in at that point. Because I mean, it was
during the breakup?
No, during the marriage.
Oh,
so,
okay.
I mean, I was using, and then we were using, and then, you know, the
together.
Fights, and then, you know, everything goes haywire, I'm working, you know, you're
that's
staying
total
up.
Chaos.
Yeah, and then you can't pay the bills, arguments, and all the stuff that goes along with drug use.
Right.
And it started spiraling. That's when I started noticing my life was starting to spiral. I didn't then, but later on I started noticing that's when
you
it
look
really
kinda,
started.
Yeah, you can kind of look back on that and be like, man, things got really crazy at this time.
Right.
Now, there's, so, you know, you go into this relationship and that leads to marriage, right? Now, was it a marriage that led to addiction, or were you guys partying really heavy together and then got married?
Well, she was a great girl, you know, and my addiction, I was fueled in my addiction already. I was already into my ego, puffed up. I was in my 20s, early 20s, 23, and, you know, I was just, you couldn't tell me anything. And I feel like more, if anything, that I incorporated the drugs into that.
Sure.
And because it was something I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this false persona of what a man should be in the family. So I was, of course, I was doing it. And then, you know, her being curious, tried it. And then next thing you know, we're both using.
Yeah.
And not to mention the alcohol and the weed as well, you know. And it just was working and doing a lot of drugs and partying. You know, we were still young, and it didn't end well. You know, it ended in divorce, and which will slingshot us on into the time that marriage was over, and then my son was born. I met this girl and started doing pain pills, and that was you know, that's where my life really started spiraling down, because not only did I smoke pot and do meth, now I found my new best friend, which really hooked me and took me down to my knees, which was pain pills and opiates.
Now, what led to, there was a pain pill, was it a reason why you got pain pills? Like, was it prescribed to you first? Or did it just become something that was given to you to, like, come down off of meth or something like that?
No. Actually, I'd met this girl, the mother of my son, and she was a hardcore opiate addict when I met her.
Okay.
And I had dabbled with them, but didn't have express a love for them as she did.
Right.
And when I met up with her, her being on them all the time, me being doing meth, and they're so expensive. Mm-hmm. So my habits kind of went to the side, because that's what guys do. They're trying to impress a girl, get with this girl.
Yeah.
Her addiction becomes your addiction. And then it was the worst mistake of my life, because I started eating, you know, hydrocodones first, 10 at a time, as soon as my feet hit the floor. I tried to stop using them a year later, and I was sick. And then that's when I realized that's what was making me sick.
Yeah.
That's when I really had an issue.
You know what, man? The reason I'm relating to this so much, because, like, this story is so similar to mine, right? Mm-hmm. And one thing that that blows my mind to this day is I got so engulfed in whenever opiates came into my life, is that I got so engulfed in it, and I had such a I had such an ignorance about it, that about getting sick. Like, I had no idea,
right,
really, that the withdrawal even was a part of using. I've heard people, like, you know, when I started using, I heard people saying, oh man, you know, people that were using longer than me that I was, like, getting drugs off of or getting high with, they're like, man, I gotta get this tomorrow, man. I gotta get my wake up because I don't wanna be sick. But I had never experienced anything like that, because when I first started using, I had such a supply that I just did it daily, and I was hooked and I didn't know it. And whenever I first withdrew it, I was like, so were you ignorant to it?
Not at first, you know. I was like, this ain't going to happen to me. But, of course, she had went through it and was always crying. I had to take her from ER to ER to ER to ER hopping when she couldn't get pills. And
but you weren't experiencing that firsthand at that time.
No, not for a good – well, I was hardcore abusing them with her. I was keeping up with her 10-year habit at that point.
Yeah.
And so I had a 10-year habit right out of the gate and was getting loaded on these things.
Right.
And it didn't take long. Within 6 months, I started getting sick, and then that's when it really, everything was spiraling out of control. She started forging scripts. She actually got in trouble for it and stealing stuff. And I was spending all my paychecks on drugs and running back and forth to ERs until finally it was hard for me to keep a job.
Yeah.
And, you know.
And you got one boy at this time, right?
No, she's pregnant. She gets pregnant.
Okay.
It's in the mix of all this. She gets pregnant, and fast forward, you know, my son, he's about to be delivered, and we're barely making it. We have over a $2,000 a week habit between the both of us together.
Wow.
And you know, the days that I don't have pain pills, I'm so sick, I'm using meth because it's cheaper. And just to get through the days,
just to get moving,
miserable.
Yeah.
You know, and I got a son that's fixing to be born, my world's sinking, my dad gets diagnosed with cancer.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And in the midst of all that, one of my uncles died from cancer just spontaneously, unexpected.
Mm.
And another gets diagnosed with it, and then my dad. So three uncles.
So it's like you're in this spiral of addiction and chaos. Your daily life is chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And then even, like, looking outside of it, it's really dark too. You're experiencing a lot of loss, like a lot of personal loss within your family, right?
Right, yeah.
That's tough, man.
Yeah. And, you know, my son goes on to be born. At that time, I realized that, you know, I'm at work. I think she's gone to her mom's or her grandma's or something. And my dad calls me and tells me that a Whitfield County detective had stopped by the house saying that he needs to speak to both of us, that he would like to speak with us before he puts out a warrant, a felony warrant for theft by taking or something, some X amount of monies. I don't think that's important, but
right.
I ignored it because I didn't know what he was talking about, and I really didn't.
Right.
And,
like you're gonna talk to a detective about anything living the way you're living, right?
Well, the guy wasn't joking around, so we never went down there and talked to him. The next thing we know, we're Whitfield County top three most wanted people in Whitfield County.
Oh, wow.
My son's born. He's 3 months old. You know, I'm freaking out. I got police circling. We're ditching and dugging. And so we go on this rampage for a while, for several weeks, before we actually get caught and turn ourselves in.
Okay. But together?
Yeah, we were together when we got caught.
Okay.
While I'm sitting in jail, my dad makes me sit in there for over 30 days, kind of drying out. Mm-hmm. That's how bad it was. Well,
that probably was no fun, the drying out process.
It was horrible.
Yeah.
You know, I was sick, but still I wasn't ready to quit. I had already made those, when I get out of here, first thing I'm doing is I'm getting high.
Isn't that crazy?
And I did.
Yeah.
And, but she ended up taking drug court. And this is important because it's going to tie in.
Sure, yeah, man.
Right,
so hey, we're listening. We're tuned in, brother.
She gets drug court. They let her out around 35 days. I was in there.
Mm-hmm.
My dad comes and bonds me out immediately. You know, we're with our son. We're staying at his house. I go.
So, I mean, is your dad's motivation to get you out? Now he's figuring that you're dried out.
He thinks, you know, at this
I was
point,
long enough.
He wanted me to get the pills out of my system because he had never seen me act
the
way I had acted and go off that far off the end doing anything else. And so I think he had a deep concern for my child and, you know, me being a parent. So he tried to do the best thing, which was leave me in there to dry out. And anyway, so he bonds me out and she goes into drug court. I go get high. We're sitting at the house. She goes to her drug court meeting. She comes back home. I have a Roxy. I'm doing it in the bathroom. She goes to drug court, tells them they take her and send her to RSAT.
Mm-hmm.
I put in a no contact order with us.
Okay.
So I have
so
my
you guys
son.
Are separate.
So I have a 4 month old son.
Wow.
In diapers that I'm taking care of. My dad's dying of cancer. The mom's gone. So I did step up at that point and kind of slacked off on everything I was doing because I wasn't still sick or physically dependent on opiates.
Right.
So I went and got a decent job, and I worked it for several months, at least 3 or 4 months straight, you know, before I got high. But then my dad got worse with his cancer and started doing chemo, and they prescribed him pain medicine, strong narcotics. And so it wasn't long before that, so I started getting them from him and using them. And so another 4 or 5 months go by, his condition keeps getting worse. They give him stronger and stronger pain medications, and I'm just doing the crap out of him while I'm working, taking care of my son, staying focused.
Maintaining.
Sending her money.
Yeah.
And doing, feel like I was doing great at it. Well, me and him bump heads. I can't get him anymore. My whole life crumbles. I'm sicker than I've ever been in my life. Right? And, you know, so I have to take my son to my mom's. Kind of drop him off. It took her a year to kind of transition through county jail and the RSAT program to get back out to drug
court.
Mom.
She's
got like 2 months before she gets out, and I have to physically, I'm staying at my mom's at this point, not my dad's, because we had a falling out, and my mom's kind of helped me take care of my son. I can't get up off the couch.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm a piece of crap. And my son's starting to walk. He's like 9 months old at this point, and I leave. 2 weeks at a time, I'm gone shooting meth hardcore because I can't get the pills anymore.
Yeah.
And then that meth monster took a hold of me. And I really spiral out of control. She gets out, comes and gets my son, and then I feel like my whole world's crushed. Shortly after my dad passes away, I go, needless to say, let me back up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
That year, after she comes and picks my son up, and before my dad dies, I check myself in and out of 7-day treatment centers.
Okay, so you're going to like detoxing. You're trying to detox.
Almost 21 times.
Wow.
Out of a year. Between the time that I'm talking about after she comes back and I give my son back to her.
Right.
Drug court puts in a no contact order. My dad dying and into a year after he dies, I'm going to 21 times out of a year. So I'm in and out.
So you're trying to get clean quick, jump back out, jail. Try to do life.
Well, I'm homeless. I'm bouncing around at this point. I still have a vehicle. I'm still holding some stuff together, working these spotty jobs, but I'm really depressed. My dad died. I don't know how to handle it. Mm. My woman and my child's gone. And I'm fueled with a raging addiction, pain pills and meth. And I'm just out there, worse than I think I've ever been. And it just don't stop at this point. I'm hardcore going to 7-day rehab just to have somewhere to go. It's like jails, institutions, or death.
Yeah.
And I was on a one-way street to death, I think, in those institutions. So
I agree. Is it in that time period where you find this bottom where...
No.
Let's keep hearing
Not
about
yet.
It.
So a few years go by. So okay. I'm talking after
So
my
you're
dad
still
dies.
Doing all this, but life is going on.
Mm-hmm. She's still in drug court. I hadn't seen my son in a couple of years. I might get in touch with her to go see him on his third birthday and his fourth birthday and his fifth.
But so she's doing good?
Yeah, at this point. She's doing great.
Okay.
Well, I'm fueled in my addiction. Well, this one time, you know, I get a large amount of methamphetamines, and I end up, there's something that happened, and I end up eating it. And it about killed me, but I didn't go to the hospital, but it really fried my brain. So at this point, you know, I'm like, something's got to change, because I mean, I almost died. I really didn't. There was nobody around me. I was just in one of those bad spots in my life, laying on the ground, flopping, and nobody to call. Nobody cares, you know.
Yeah.
And I burn all my bridges.
You're alone.
I'm alone. And it is a scary feeling with no hope. And so I'm like, I got to do something different. So I crawled my way over to my uncle, which is a three-phase power guy. His name's not important. And so I work with him. He allows me first to start weeding his garden.
Then okay. So you come to him. What are you like? Say, man, I'm messed up. Can you help me? Is that one of those things? Is it a conversation
It was to a point to where I hadn't seen my son. I had to start paying child support, and I was sick. I almost died. I mean, and it really kind of brought me to a realization. I wanted to get sober, but I didn't know how. I never really had great parenting, you know, and I didn't know how. I didn't have any of the resources that I found here at Vision Warriors and in North Atlanta. And I wish I would have had that opportunity then, and maybe I could have fast-forwarded to where I am now. But that wasn't the case, and nor was I ready, I don't guess, at that time. So.
Right.
I worked with him for almost a year, stayed completely sober from meth from that day forward. I started working with him from meth and opiates for a whole year, but I was drinking like
a fish.
How
did you do that? I mean, that's a big thing to step over right there. You just stopped while you're working?
Well, I couldn't get the pills. I was so far down and out. My dad had died, and I didn't know where to get them at this point.
Okay, got you.
But I had a horrible meth addiction, and I was cheating, ripping people off, whatever I did to get it, and just... nobody would mess with me anymore. It was that bad. Like it was, there was, I beat myself down that
bad
that the slummers didn't even want to hang out with me. Right. So at this point, you know, I stay there and I work. I meet a lot of other people in the community who are really great people that live across the street from my uncle. And I work with him full time. You know, I stay in his motorcycle shop. There's no water, no power, or there is power. And he had a gas heat and a cable TV, and I had a little cot in this motorcycle shop. And I would get up every morning, stack the lumber, and done some really good jobs with him. I learned a lot, and I cleaned out, but I was drinking heavily. And I didn't realize that that'd be a problem because I'd never really drank. You know, I had some run-ins with alcohol, but not to this point. So, I mean, I was getting sloppy, fall down drunk every night.
Yeah.
Drinking 18 to 30 packs a day, like, because I didn't have anything else to do but sit in that shop and think. Started paying my child support. Trying to get some normalcy, but I didn't get to see my son as much at that point. But I was trying to do what I had to do to move forward. Well, after a year, I kind of got a truck and a vehicle, and I was still staying in his motorcycle shop.
Yeah.
And I started hanging out with old friends.
They just popped
back
in.
And I was drinking.
Yeah, they kind of pop back in when you're...
Right.
You got a couple dollars in your pocket, you're working, you drive by... They're waiting.
And that's when I went to a hotel in Calhoun and met an old friend of mine and had a little money, a little jingle in my pocket, and ran into an old friend and I met my daughter's mom. And then that started that whole episode.
Let me interject really fast, okay? And we'll jump back because I think it's something is just like while you're telling me this story. it just, you know, so many people, like, because when you hear, like, somebody, you know, maybe dying of an overdose, right? Or you hear of somebody in jail because of drugs, or they're addicts, right? Mm-hmm. And, like, I think in a lot of people's heads, it's just like somebody that goes from here, and then they just shoot down into nothing, you know, then they end up in jail, or they're dead, or whatever. Mm-hmm. But what, you know, and I really appreciate this story, because you're giving people an idea of, like, what the high wire act looks like. Like, you have a trade, like, it's, you're a talented person, right? Inside of you is this hard worker, mm-hmm. okay? But you're trying to maintain this lifestyle while trying, it's like you're doing two totally different things at once. Mm-hmm. One side of you is this guy that's a full-time worker that knows things, that has experience in different trades through different opportunities. However, there's another side of you that's going through this whole, like, okay, you know, I'm just, I'm drinking now, but I ain't doing meth so much. Oh, now I got this opiate addiction, but, you know, I quit doing that, and I'm just, you know, now I'm doing meth. It's like this, like, juggling act, mm-hmm. you know, on this high wire that you're trying to maintain, like, some sort of life while having all these horrific things, like, throw these huge curveballs at you constantly over. And that's like, your daily life, mm-hmm. living that way. You know, it's definitely unmanageable, but in your head, you're saying, well, I'm still working. You know, maybe you're paying child support sometime. You know, maybe you're seeing your kid every once in a while. You know, people mm-hmm. are still respecting you at your job, you know, and it's, but it's actually like just like prolonging this, like, you know, this really bad lifestyle. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I just want, like, the audience to be able to really absorb that, that it's not always like this, you know, this, you know, this just drop off a cliff type of life. There is this, like, trying to keep it together, and like it goes on for years sometimes. Yeah, in your case, it went on for years.
Yes.
You know, and what's really happening is there's this addictive person, and it really doesn't matter what it is. You have this addictive personality that's, whether it's alcohol mm-hmm. or meth or marijuana or opiates, you know, it's just like you're going to do it to the extreme every single time. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I'm sorry, I just wanted to, I felt like that needed to be said here, because that's what's, that's what's being revealed to me as this conversation goes on.
Right. Right. And at this point, so I'm jobless now with a bad addiction again.
Yeah.
Running out of funds fast at $200 a week for a weekly motel and a dope motel at that.
Yeah.
With a pregnant girlfriend again. In a worse position. I already got a son I'll get to see. And then I'm already to the point now to where my addiction has fueled me. When I get it, I don't even care to socialize with anybody. I go straight to get it, and I go straight back around, and I'm doing it. I don't want nobody around me. You know, if you're doing it with me, that's fine, but I'm not sharing unless you're my girlfriend. Yeah. And that's it. That's my life. To work, just to go get dope. And I'm hustling, you know. So she's there at the hotel room pregnant. I'm out after work hustling all night long trying to get my fix for the next day, and that becomes my life for a short time. Fast forward, a lot of other bad things happen. You know, I meet a lady that's dying of cancer, really good lady, and she's got 100 milligram morphines, and you know, they're cheap, and so she becomes my new best friend. It's a great lady. So being a user and abuser on pain pills, I've met a lot of people that have died because that's who I got them from, and that's sad. But they're really great people. And so if I fast forward with that a little bit, you know, my baby's born, we split up.
Yeah.
And I'm homeless at this point. Okay. She leaves me because I'm always out looking
takes
for pills.
The kid.
Spending my whole, takes my daughter. I'm spending my whole paycheck on meth. Don't care about anything else. My addictions really took root. I mean, like, it had been for a long time, but it's worse than it's ever been. Like, I'm homeless and I don't care. Mm. I'm going to work, sleep behind dumpsters. And spending, instead of eating, I'm spending my last $20, $15 on a pain pill.
Yeah.
And don't care. Yeah. And don't care about anything else. And it's sad. And I look back on it now, like how sad that was. So at that point, I become homeless. Mm-hmm. You know, and for almost 4 years, I stayed that way. Wow. Working these odds and end carpenter jobs because I still had some skills and nobody really cared how messed up you were as long as you done good work and you were there every day. So I made it a point if I was sick or high. Some days I don't even know how I made it to work. I was so messed up. Mm-hmm. But I done okay work and they kept paying me and it was just fueling this addict and I was ripping and all the stuff that comes along with people that are strung out that bad drugs.
Oh yeah.
You know? And in that I got mixed around just stealing some stuff from Walmart.
Right.
$10, some food.
Mm-hmm.
And I fought that all the way off. I was homeless down in the hole in the meantime while I'm trying to juggle going to court in Gatlinburg, dealing with all that, and finally got that squashed.
Mm.
Now, you know, I got this Walmart thing, and I go in there, and the DA in Dalton's like, you know what, with a record like yours, you're going to do some jail time. I was like, dude, just give me a year probation, let me out of here. And he's like, no. I feel like at that point, the people in the county know. They were like, you know, we need to let this kid dry out some.
Yeah.
So I served 60 days in jail after I fought it on bond for almost a year. It's like, you got to go to jail. So I hit this bottom at that point to where I was like, I didn't have anywhere to go. It was cold. Mm-hmm. And I was...
You're talking about after the 60 days?
No, before.
Before, okay.
So I'm whittled down to nothing. I might be 110 pounds. It's cold outside. I've run into roadblocks. My pill got sick. I don't know where he's at. Mm-hmm. Can't get them. I call them off. Like, just take me to jail, or I'm gonna miss court and not go. You know.
Yeah.
So I go check myself into jail a week early to start my 60 days.
Right.
And it was the best decision I ever made. You know. So I got sober in there. It was a long 60 days, but I felt normal when I got out. Mm-hmm. And I called the guy I was working for in Gatlinburg almost 2 years.
I mean, what is normal though, man?
Right.
I mean, your whole life is living one way, you know, so
right.
What's going, like, you're walking out the door now. Do you have a plan after the 60 days, or you're feeling like, you know?
I didn't know, you know, I just knew that I was at a dead end street and I was headed to a bottom I didn't know, and I didn't want to go to prison. So I went and took care of that. I was like, I don't know, we'll see what happens. So I'd already made those reservations to get high again, you know, when I got out, and how good it was going to be. I've been sober 6 days. It's really going to knock my socks off or whatever. That's just the way opiate addicts think, right?
Right.
But, you know, actually when I got out, my mom actually worked with me and let me stay there for a few weeks. It never lasts long with her. We have some issues.
Yeah.
But, you know, I got my job back with the guy I mentioned earlier in Gatlinburg and told him I've been sober 60 days. So I started working for him, really doing these jobs, and I was excited. And I stayed sober for about 2, maybe 3 months, stashed every paycheck back, and I found a little apartment in Calhoun. A week before I moved out of my mom's, I start using pills again, go take all the money from her that I'd saved, got this apartment, and still she didn't know at this point, but I act like I was fine. And started, you know, dabbling around with meth again and pills. And so, you know, I'm in my apartment. This is toward the end of my story. I'm closing, I promise.
No, you're good.
So I'm in this little Jack Shack apartment, which was a perfect spot I could have grew and really put myself back together in with this opportunity that Tim gave me. But I needed a vehicle. I was riding a bicycle back and forth to work, and he was adamant about me getting there on time, and he wanted to see where I was at. So, you know, I was like, man, I found this car. And he picked me up the next morning for work. And I was like, where are we going, man? He's like, well, I'm going to take you up here to give you a drug test. If you pass it, I'll give you the money to buy this car, and you can pay me back. I'm like, man, I ain't going to pass it. Well, what's in your system? Pain pills. He said, gosh, dog it. You know, he took me up there, and I failed the test like I said I would. And he fired me that day.
Wow.
He said he wasn't going to enable me like that anymore. Yeah. And he was serious. It was the best choice he ever did, because after that, dude.
That's love right there.
And he knew a lot of the other workers in Calhoun, Georgia, where I was at.
Yeah.
And I think they were all like, no, we're not going to work you. And
also, word kind of went around.
And I didn't want to be homeless again. I'd already hit that bottom. I had my apartment for a little while after being 6 days in jail, having them three hots in a cot. You know, I was kind of transitioned. And I'll never forget that brokenness. This is where that brokenness hit, because all my friends had gone away. I wasn't working anymore. You know, I was stuck up there fixing to get kicked back out on the street.
Yeah.
And I had a decision to make. Was I just going to keep chasing, doing what I was doing?
Yeah.
And either die or go to prison. And God, like, spoke to me somewhere in there. You know, that was a long 2 weeks. I laid there sick in that bed, and 2 days from getting kicked out of the apartment, you know, I prayed, you know. I was like, God, you know, I'm sick, and I promise I'll never use drugs again if you can just help me. I don't know what to do. And I remembered somebody in jail that said,
where did you, if you don't mind me asking, where does this influence of even, like, praying to God, like, where does that?
Well, I've always been a Christian. I was raised that way. That's the roots mm-hmm. of my family. You know, I've always had right. this concept okay. of a higher power in Jesus.
Gotcha.
I never walked that path. Yeah. I didn't know what that path even looked like until recently. And you know, I prayed, and I just knew there was something above me, something spiritual, something higher than me, God, Jesus. Yes. And, you know, I was like, I'll do anything. If you just help me get through this, I'll never look back. And, yeah. you know, somebody had mentioned to me before something about sober living in America. Mm-hmm. And so, and the girl that I had kind of been messing with, she was like, I'm going to this rehab or whatever. So I'm like, I'm not doing this again. So I'd never tried to get sober and go somewhere and get help other than a 7-day rehab. And I knew I wasn't doing that again, a hospital. I'll right. be right back out in the same position. I really needed a change, and I knew it. I needed somewhere to get my feet up under me.
Right.
And get clean and have that time to rest and really do some self-meditating and some self-healing and some self-exploration of who I am. And the things that I lost in my addiction. Mm-hmm. So I tried sober living in America. I was there.
Well, I'm telling you what, even to say that, that's God, like, working
tired.
In your life right there.
I was tired.
I mean, to give you that perspective, because, you know, that's not in your life. Like, those ideas of, like, doing things, just looking at life that way and knowing, like, I don't know how I'm trying to put it, like, knowing, you know, you got to get better and, like, how to go about it. Like, mm-hmm. How you just described what you needed. I see that as, like, you know, God giving you guidance right there. You know?
Right. You know, and my brothers played a big role in that, because by this time, my whole family, I mean, it had been 5 years since I even been to a Christmas function or anything. They just mm-hmm. forgot all about me. They didn't want me around. My own right. family. And my brother always used to tell me, my oldest brother, he's like, there was a guy in Calhoun, and he would push this buggy. Packed over with tarps, and he had a dog and his wife, and he's always yelling at his wife pushing this buggy. And my brother had called me and told me, he said, you know that guy in Calhoun that always pushed that buggy? He said, that's going to be you, man, if you don't do something. Mm. And that hit me deep, man. That really hit me deep, and that's what I always thought
very
about.
Very real, brother.
I don't even have a buggy. You know, that guy's yeah. got a buggy and a wife and a dog, and I don't even have nothing but a book bag and a right. broken bike. You know,
real, Calhoun's doing better than you. Yeah. You know what yeah. I'm saying?
Like, and that really saying. Hit me deep coming yeah, from my brother, man. You know. And but during that time, I had a friend that was looking to come to a rehab, and he ended up at Vision Warriors. Mm-hmm. I had never heard of Vision Warriors, but I did during that time when I left and then went back to the hospital trying to find another sober living. I was at Peachford, yeah. and I called, and Kirk answered the phone, and it was Vision yeah. Warriors. They said, this guy might give you an opportunity.
Yeah.
But before I got the confirmation from Curtin to come over there for the meeting, I stopped, and of course I go get me a little bottle of Jack Daniels and I drink it.
Oh, man.
So I get over there and I take the drug test, and I fell for alcohol. And I was like, man, you know, but the grace of God is great. And those guys said, you know, they let me go to a 7-day detox and come back to Vision Warriors when I got out, and I've been there ever since.
Yeah.
And I thank God for that. And that,
that is
started
a blessing
my journey.
Right there,
yeah.
man. What a blessing that you get back and the boys let you in, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to go too much into that, like, that whole process, but it's a very, you know, Vision Wars is this very special place, you guys, that, you know, that just gives you opportunity, man. And the way they go about things at that church is, it's not typical, and it's just, it's a life changer. I will say that from firsthand experience, just from seeing and observing it, how that program works. It's a very special place to be, you know, and I just want to put that out there. But so you go through this, so you know, I want to back up just a little bit, all right, because I do want to talk about a little bit about what that surrender looks like, because we're, I feel like we just walked over it, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You're surrendering to your higher power,
right,
saying, you know, you want thing, you know, you want, tell me what that is. I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Well, you know, for me that day, something was different inside me, deep inside me, my heart, my mind. I was broken, man. And I knew, I just had this feeling, I just, there was a change or a shift, so to, if you want to call it that, inside of me. And I was done, man. Like, I was licked. I truly couldn't go anymore. I didn't want to be home, man. I couldn't do it anymore, man. And I just, you know, my pastor always says, you know, the pain, change occurs when the pain of staying the same is greater than the pain of change.
Wow.
I don't know whose quote that is or where that came from, but right. It's true. And that's where I was that day. And if I'm being real with you, man, I was broken, man. And I was crying from the inside. I was screaming out. And the only thing I could think of was Jesus and God. Like, God, you're the only thing I know that could have control over this situation. And I truly surrendered that day. Like, I was tired. If it meant that I couldn't ever do drugs or opiates ever again, or meth, or hang out with the same people, I was willing to sacrifice anything that I was doing to get better, to not feel the way I was feeling. Because I was, like, to that point to where I was either going to kill myself or gonna go out and do a whole bunch of drugs and just die, because I didn't have anywhere else to go, man. And I'd hit that bottom. Like, there was no further. Like, I had dug a hole into that bottom, and it was, I was in bedrock. Like, death was around the corner, and I know it was.
So that's surrender right there.
That was my surrender.
That's your surrender. So now, God is leading your life, right? And you're in this, things are happening, probably that isn't, you know, as much of like an arrow pointing in that direction, but, you know, you're getting, you know, you're placed into this, in an environment, a sober living environment, where, you know, everybody is making this attempt to change. And they're also making an attempt to let God in there, let their higher power in their life to guide them through it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Letting their higher power grab the steering wheel, in other words. So you're going through there, right? Now, what is this early change looking like? Is it rainbows? Is it like really difficult? I mean, what is it? What's that vision like?
Well, fortunately for me, when I got there, I mean, I was uncomfortable for one, and the level of accountability that was there was I had to make an oath.
Yeah.
Once I was accepted and voted in, I had 1 week to get a job, just off the top.
Yeah.
You know, 1 week to get a job, and if I used, I had to tell. And, you know, I'm still here today, so that tells you anything. Honesty is real, and transparency is real.
That is it. Oh. That's the changer, yeah.
But it was rough. Yeah. You know, I've always knew how to work, so it wasn't an issue for me. And I spent 30 days, you know, over there at Sober Living America. So I knew how to get a job because I've worked. I've always worked. I went straight to a temp service, had a job in 3 days. But then I realized once I kept going to meetings, my first 6 months there was pretty tough, you know, just trying to catch up, paying child support for both my children, and then working, being around people, and changing. And then I realized, you know, I have all these character defects. And they were bad. I was still raw right off the street from a long run. And didn't know how to act, you know, around civilized people, so to speak. I was in more of an animalistic state of survival.
And primal.
I was oblivious to the grace and the love at Vision Words. They showed it to me, but I was like, this is just a cover. I didn't fully trust the program at this point of the community.
Right.
And that they had the best intentions for me when it was, and that was a lie, you know.
Right. And I think that's I think that's something that we should note too, that, you know, I think, you know, where a higher power and a community, right, a fellowship is so important in recovery. And I'll give it to you like this, right? A lot of guys try to get clean, right? And what happens whenever they have a couple weeks clean and they don't have a higher power and they don't have a fellowship, they don't have a network, they don't have those things, is I think what happens is they have to face life, man. Mm-hmm. And when you're doing that just clean and you're seeing child support, even if you got a temp job, right? Mm-hmm. And you're seeing child support and these bills and these life on life situations, and you don't have like nobody to lean on, nobody to have guidance, get guidance from, you know what I mean? And you don't have God in your life to like tell you that, hey, let's get through today. You know, I got you. If you don't have those things, man, while you're facing life trying to dig out of this hole, I don't even know how I don't know how it happens. Yeah. I really don't know how it happens, man. You know,
at this point, you know, up to 6 months in, or even past that, you know, I still didn't know who I was. I didn't know my identity. I was just a junkie, and that was my perception of me. Mm-hmm. And I felt like that was other people's perception of me. And you know, but everybody around me was steadfast at work. They all had something that I wanted when I got there. Mm-hmm. And continual meetings that was pushed on me. You know, I would take food. I mean, I got in a couple of trouble times. I would take people's food because I was just in that mentality.
Right.
And they would call me out on it.
Right.
And then I would have to go into that and humble myself to be like, yeah, you know, I did it. Yeah, everybody knew. And they all had grace on me for that, you know. And I'll never forget those days. But there's a lot of people, you know, I really looked up to there.
Yeah.
That they've came and gone in positive transitions. But, mm-hmm. you know, they played a big part of me staying sober. Mm-hmm. And, especially, you know, my first Christmas, Thanksgiving, you know, I had this urge, like I wanted to be around my family. I figured out it was owed to me because I'm sober now. I'm doing the right things, but they still wasn't ready. They wanted to see a long-term commitment.
Right.
I think I see that now.
Sure.
But, you know, I didn't go home at all. You know, my first year at Vision Warriors, it was work there, meetings. I stayed there. I planted myself there. And even the second year, you know, I went out for like Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. But I think Christmas, you know, I kind of hung close, you know. It was still, there was a moment, you know, at 6 months sober for me to where I was like, man, I can't believe I'm doing it. It's been 6 months since I stuck a needle. I had this realization like, holy crap, I'm doing it. I've never been this long without anything, right? And like I sat on that porch over at one of the properties, the Vision Warriors, and I was like, man, like early in the morning doing my devotion, I was like, this is happening. Like either I can go back out now, because or I'm fixing to go. And if I keep going, it's I'm changed forever. And I made that commitment. At that point, I feel like I
guess
committed.
That's like a crossroad.
It took me 6 months. Right. Either I can keep going back. Like I've went too far, and right now, if I keep going, I got to stay the course. Like, or I can give up now. And I was at that point in my head, and I was like, I committed and kept moving forward. And that's what brought me here today.
Yeah.
Yeah, not to mention, you know, the great people, you know, shout out to Path Light Counseling, Britt Paramore, David Cleo, Judy, you know, Kirk Driscoll, and Scott Dahl, and those guys. And then also Restoration Church, you know, Chuck Ramsey and his discipleship class, and all the people and counselors there. There's a great men's group, prayer groups there. And surrounding myself with those types of people and getting great insight, God really blessed me with having those type of people to really help me and sharpen me and shape me to what I've become today. And I'm not perfect. I still have a lot of growth that needs to be done. But, man, if I turn around and look where
village,
I come from,
man
I couldn't, for the longest time in recovery, I couldn't see the growth that I had. Like other people are like, man, you look great, you're doing great, but I still didn't feel it. I'm to that point now where I'm starting to realize, like, wow, I've came a long way. Like, you know, especially, you know, the way my kids and children look at me, the mothers of my children and the grandparents of my children, the way they look at me, and I'm there to help. I'm a rock. I'm consistent. I'm there if they need anything. You know, I try to be there for them. I try to pray for everyone and do right by everybody.
You know, not only do, you know, when I look at you, do I see commitment, but when I look at you, man, I see such an inspiration. You know what I mean? And I hope this gets put on the app soon. You know what I mean? And I hope, you know, the people that are listening to it live, maybe, you know, you tell somebody that's having a struggle, maybe thinking that they're unable to make it out of whatever situation that they're in. I mean, if you listen to Joe's story, you're seeing proof of that, you know, and it's been an honor, bro. It's been an honor for you to be here. We thank you. Man, we just got finished talking to Joe, guys. Thank you guys for tuning in. We appreciate it. Joe, man, thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
I appreciate you, brother.
Thanks the most high.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you for watching. If you would like to talk about what you've seen and heard today, or just check in on your recovery and mental health, please join us in a virtual meeting every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday at 8 p.m. Eastern. If you need more than a safe place to share, we may be able to get you the help you deserve. Remember, you are worth recovery. Download the Most High Media app for more recovery and spiritual content. We have a Netflix of recovery.